This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I have with me Dr. Hud Berry, who is a faithful member of this cathedral and has been here longer than I have. How many years have you been at the cathedral, Hud? It's beyond my tenure.
2002.
2002, great. Hud is a orthopedic surgeon and a member of our choir, a great singer. But we're going to be looking at his life as a surgeon today. Hud is also, what is your role in the military? How did you get involved in that, Hud?
I grew up in the Army. My dad was an Army doctor. He had been deferred from service through the Second World War. He graduated in 1945, and then he went into pediatrics, and then he took a fellowship in adolescent medicine in New Orleans. Then I came along, and the Korean War came along, and they needed doctors. And so he felt bad about missing the Second World War, so he joined the Army. We lived in Germany in the early, mid-50s.
So you just spent your childhood in the Army.
Yeah.
And then did you go straight into the Army in college? Or?
Well, I went to West Point.
West Point, okay, got it. Yeah,
so,
and from there.
So I was an in-service draft dodger.
Gotcha.
So my draft number in 1968 was 14.
Mm-hmm.
So West Point was a good place to sit out the war. Not that we were sitting it out, really. We were the rebels of our generation. You know, people, we did not, because of the antipathy towards the military, we did not even fill up our class.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, we had 1,250 spots, something like that. But they didn't change any of the standards, but we did not fill the class. Mm-hmm. And then we lost a third of our class through the 4 years. And then I graduated and with a civil engineering degree and went into the artillery.
Okay.
And jumped out of airplanes, shot cannons, and then went to got accepted to medical school, and the Army sent me to medical school after that in Galveston, and basically as a civilian. And then I went to Hawaii for my orthopedic training. Tough going from Galveston to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. It was hard. And it was a great program. And then when Raleigh and I got married between our sophomore and junior year, and we went to Hawaii. She got a master's in computer sciences at the University of Hawaii while I was there. A very stressful time for both. Both very, very demanding programs. Mm-hmm. And then we said, well, what are we going to do next? Where are we going to go? You have to go someplace for a utilization tour. And so we'd both lived in Germany as kids. I said, well, you know, we had years on the island in Galveston. We've been 4 years here in Hawaii. And wouldn't it be nice to get back to Germany, do some skiing, European culture, and all that goes with that? Yeah. And so I put down my dream list, my dream sheet of all these. There was about 6 or 7 Army hospitals that were over there. And then if I didn't have one of those, then there was 3 hospitals on the East Coast. There's Fort Devens up in near Boston, West Point or Fort Belvoir near. And so the consultant, the guy who makes the decisions about where you're going to go, sent us to Panama.
Oh, wow. What a difference.
Yeah. Well, we'd met in Panama because that's where our parents were stationed when I was in medical school and she was a senior at Bowling Green in Ohio. And I spent 3 years down there as the chief of the orthopedic service and then did my orthopedic oncology fellowship up in Boston at MGH, which is, to most people, it's Massachusetts General Hospital, but people in the know really know that it means man's greatest hospital, right? And it's a Harvard hospital, and so I had an appointment to Harvard as well. And then I went to Walter Reed. And at Walter Reed, I started an orthopedic tumor program, ran the amputee clinic.
Wow, lots of amazing experience.
And then, you know, I was in and out of Central America, and then went to Desert Storm in 1990, and I was gone for there for 10 months or so. And then came back and then retired. I was the top of the orthopedic food chain as far as the Army was. I was the head of orthopedics at Walter Reed, and I was the consultant for the Surgeon General for orthopedics. But then if you're gonna get promoted, you're gonna stop being a doctor.
Yeah, right. And
you know, I basically had assurances that this was going to happen. And that was really important to me when I was younger. You know, I saw things that were broken that I could try to fix. Because it's all about taking care of patients. And the things that get away in the way of taking care of patients, you need to fix. But I couldn't do that, so I got a job at... I went down to the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas and was there for 3 years, and then got recruited to the University of Florida as the professor and chair of orthopedics and down in Gainesville. And I was there for 6 years and then moved up here to reconstitute the program at Shands up here in Jacksonville.
And so you landed here in about 2004?
2002.
2002.
2002, okay. 2002. Yeah.
So how do you retire and then you decide to go to Ukraine, which is, how does that work? You're obviously a devout Episcopalian. Tell me a little bit about, as a doctor and a person of faith, what made you feel like you were supposed to go to Ukraine? How did you come to that conclusion?
When you spend a lifetime doing what I do, there are very few people that have the skill set that I have. I mean, I'm primarily known as an orthopedic cancer surgeon, but I've taken care of soldiers all my life. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you've spent a lifetime accumulating those skills and that knowledge, how do you walk away from it?
Right. Yes.
And I've done a bit of missionary work, or this type of work in the Army, and then afterwards, Raleigh and I had been down to Haiti a couple times. We went down right after the earthquake in 2010.
And tell me when you go to a place like Haiti as a doctor and you're able to help people, tell me about what that's like for you. Spiritually, I guess it's hard physically, but probably it makes you feel like you have even more of a purpose than what you're doing here. Or is it a little different than doing medicine here?
It truly is absolutely different. I mean, these people have no way of paying you.
Yes.
You're not worried about the paperwork or the insurance companies or pre-authorizations. It really is medicine in its purest form.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say pure medicine, yeah.
But it's exhausting, too.
Mm-hmm. There's only so much the body and mind can take, yeah.
Well, but there are limitations on what you can do with people. I think, you know, I went with the hospital ship to the Philippines mm-hmm. in 1986. No, 87, when the hospital ship came online, and Reagan sent it to the Philippines on a goodwill gesture. And we had lots and lots of people who needed orthopedic care, but you couldn't do anything because your treatment wasn't going to be completed. I mean, orthopedic care is measured in weeks and months.
Yeah, it's not just about fixing the bone.
And it was very, very frustrating with that. So, but again, it's, people understand, I think they understand that you can't fix them, mm-hmm. but you can care for them. Mm-hmm. And it's that act of caring that I think is the most renewing or spiritual uplifting thing that a doctor can do. One of the things I've done throughout, and it's, it kind of goes along with this, is, you know, taking care of cancer patients, you know, that's a tough gig.
Yes, it is.
So I'd have in my pocket a little bag of St. Peregrine medals. Hmm. And St. Peregrine is the patron saint for cancer patients and hopeless afflictions and whatnot. And so I would give these to my patients. And almost universally they said that was such an act of kindness or hope for them. And it just meant, and then I would meet, and I still have my St. Christopher medal, you know.
Oh, that's beautiful. So just getting them a little bit of a touch of God's comfort.
Amen.
And not even saying much about it, just handing it to them. I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So tell us about the people of Ukraine. We hear a lot in the news, but we don't see what it's like on the ground. Tell us about maybe a story or two about some of the people and their resilience. I admire them so much.
They are truly deserving of all the help and assistance we can give them. When you look at what's going on from a geopolitical point of view, this really is a crunch point in history. I liken this to the mid-1930s with the rise of Hitler and the fact that the West did not stop him. Mm-hmm. And he kept testing the West, and the West kept failing.
Yeah.
We're in sort of the same timeline. And you only recognize history after the events have already occurred.
That's true.
So are we looking at this as much like the issues with tariffs and embargoes that we had with Japan that led up to the Pearl Harbor and the Second World War in the Pacific? Are we acquiescing to the pressure of Putin? I mean, the whole the threat level is increased with the rise of nuclear weapons, and you can see these guys blabber, the Russians blabber about it all the time. But the more, and I think it's probably similar to what you had in London during the Blitz, okay? The Blitz, the V1, V2 rockets that Hitler was shooting into into English cities, killed 45,000-50,000 people, you know, demolished neighborhoods, you know. And they didn't have the wherewithal that we to defend themselves.
Yeah.
But the English spirit shone through.
Yes, it did.
And so that's the part of history that we're reliving now. The Ukrainians are incredibly resilient. They are God-fearing. There is a spirit that exists in them. When you look at the country, about the western third is Catholic,
mm-hmm.
okay? And the eastern half or third is Orthodox,
yes.
okay? But they're all very spiritually driven. I've been through many churches. There have been many, many services with them. And there's one church in Lviv, which is a far western city. And it's there's a poster there with all of these children's faces there. And the main question is, why did my daddy have to die?
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And the barbarity that the Russians show. I mean, their scorn for Western values is mind-boggling. You can't really express the depths of depravity that they have. And it's inculcated throughout their military system. I don't know whether when you have a closed information system, people only know what they hear.
Yes.
And when you control the narrative, mm-hmm. then that's, but the Ukrainians have been stepped on throughout history. I mean, they had the Greeks, they had the Romans, they had the Turks, they had the Mongols, they had, you know, they were Austro-Hungary, Lithuania, Russia, and Russia's been the big bad guys for the last, and they want to stomp it.
They want to annihilate them as a country.
They do, because actually the origins of Russia lay in Ukraine.
Mm. Yes, the origins of Eastern Orthodoxy in Kiev. Right?
Kiev, yes. The Great Gates of Kiev.
Yep. And they want that city for their own.
Right.
So some of this is religious-based, which is horrific for us. Absolutely. Christians. It's just so embarrassing. Give us an example. I mean, you're seeing these young men then coming to you with broken bodies. What can you do for them as a doctor when you see them? Are you equipped? Do you have enough equipment? What's going on there on the ground?
That is really hard. They are dealing with wounds that we would find very difficult to deal with in our most advanced orthopedic programs.
And why is that?
Well, so a lot of my work has been in Lviv, which is in the far west part of the country. The fighting is on the northeast and the eastern side. Ukraine's the size of Texas. Okay. In our military medical history from Vietnam on, we've had guys that we can, you know, if you're injured on the battlefield, you can be in an operating room in an hour.
Yes.
Maybe two. Okay.
Right.
I was taking care of a British patient and looked at his story of his evacuation. He was on a stretcher. He got injured in a mortar blast, artillery blast. Then he was on a stretcher for 8 hours. Then he was done some, so it took him about 12 hours to get to his initial point of care.
I see. So you're not getting to them in time. They're not getting to you in time.
They're too far away. They're not getting, yeah.
Yeah.
And these are horrific injuries. So the part that I don't know, because they haven't let me go as far east as I would like, because I don't know whether the conditions that we set up so that when you're trying to deal with prevent infections, and that's really what you're doing when you're taking care of a fresh battle wound, you're trying to prevent infections. You're trying to get all the dead compromised tissue out, you're getting it all cleaned up, and then you want the wound closed as soon as you can to prevent infections. But if you don't have the time to deal with this when they come in, if you don't have the resources, if you don't have the knowledge base or the skill set or a combination of all these things, is that initial surgery, which is really the most important part, is that is that done well? Mm-hmm. And I don't. They've made huge strides with there. But then the rest of the evacuation chain is all on the ground and it's very slow. And so by the time they end up, we've got bugs that we don't have antibiotics for, you know, but the Ukrainians are very resilient. They're very strong. They're very West looking. All right. They want to be a part of Europe. They want to be, they are Europeans. Yeah. They're Europeans. And they want to, the fact that they have battled Russia basically to a stalemate when you're a third of the size.
It's incredible.
And you don't, and a third of the resources. And I could go on about the support that we have given them. I mean, we've been so cowed by Russia and their nuclear saber rattling, and every time they draw a red line, we go past it. Nothing happens with it. But Europe has a much larger population, much bigger economy than Russia does, and so does America. But we have been laggards in providing them the aid. They could have had this war won if we had given them what they wanted when they wanted it. We've dribbled it out. And so that's really what's kept it going, and that's what's kept people dying.
Well, what can we do from our end,
Clive? I think the biggest thing that Ukrainians want to know is that the American people are behind them. I often use the example of the American Revolution because it's very similar. It's a very similar story. You've been this vassal state, and you want to break free. All right, and that's really what Ukraine is doing now. And if France had turned their back on us or said, "Oh yeah, we'll give you help, but we want to control all your ports,"
right,
you know, rather than looking at it as the right thing to do.
Yeah, that's what we lack right now is ethically what is the right thing to do.
The moral courage
side of that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, rather than conditioning it on, it's a deal, it's a business proposition, whatnot. It really should be, this is the moral, correct, right, ethical path to pursue, because this truly is, in my view, it's an existential threat to freedom and Western thought, Western ideals, self-determination, independent, liberty, personal freedoms, all of that which is at risk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if we don't deal with that, then really the Russians have made no effort to hide the fact that they want to reconstitute, Imperial Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Putin sees himself as the fifth great czar. He wants to, if Ukraine folds, you've got the Baltics, Moldova, Romania, all the ones that were behind the Iron Curtain are going to be falling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can't let them in. They need prayers. They need to know that the American people are behind them, which is, just showing up. Just the fact that you have taken the time to be there for them. you may not have really anything to offer them. You know, hopefully you've got some skills you can give or money or whatnot. But the fact that you're there, it's not easy to get there.
No, it's not.
I mean, you got to fly to Poland and then take a train or a bus or car or something across. And I mean,
so what if the cathedral were to funnel donations somewhere? What is the best way to donate to Ukraine?
I work with a number of different NGOs.
Yep.
The two that I've worked the closest with is one called Med Global. They're out of Chicago.
Med Global.
Med Global.
That's an easy title. Medicine
right.
Global. I like that. Yep.
And they're an international organization. They're very heavily involved in Syria and Gaza.
Okay, great.
With that,
great.
I mean, they...
That may be a good place for us to focus.
Yeah. Zahir Salul is the president of the organization. He's a Syrian at birth and came to the country. He's a critical care. He was in Ukraine like within a month of when the war started. He spent lots of time in Syria and Jordan, and so that's one. But so they really have a global focus with that. But they're happy to take help, they operate on a shoestring, I think, for all of the. I mean, they've got Ecuador and Bangladesh and Syria and Mexico.
So is it best to make a general donation and let them figure out where the greatest need is at the time? Or what would you suggest?
Well, what has happened, I think, is that with all of the attention Israel and Gaza and Syria are getting, that's taken away a lot of the attention from Ukraine.
Yes, it has, yeah.
And so
your market for Ukraine right now might be best.
There's another organization called Razom for Ukraine. Razom is Razom, and that is Ukrainian for together.
Okay.
And so that is all specifically Ukrainian driven.
I see.
It's from organized by the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States, mm-hmm. mostly out of New York.
Okay. Well, we'll be working at, I'll work with you, Hud, to get the specifics of that so that we can...
I would love to have Ukrainian event.
Here?
Yes.
Oh, that
we could.
Cool.
That we could, you know, because supposedly there's a large Ukrainian population, Eastern European population in this area, and I don't know how to get them together. I mean, there are organizations in most of the Ukrainian immigration has been into the north, the northwest, midwest, mm-hmm. north midwest, mm-hmm. And there's lots of there's another organization. There's a SCAD of
will work on that. Yeah. Well, I thank you and I really thank you, Hud, and we're going to be praying for you as you continue your ministry. And we're blessed to know a doctor who's not afraid to get into the very dangerous areas of this world and continue to do your work. So God bless you, and thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you very much, and always happy to chat with you.
Thank you for joining me in this podcast. May God bless you and keep you always.